Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Chris Bernor.
And we have with us a very special guest, Tosin Toast Anafawakin. Tosin is a tech consultant with Box.com, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What exactly does Box.com do for those who aren't familiar?
So what Box specializes in is storage and collaboration. So we individuals as well as companies can put their files up on Box and we will store it there in the cloud so that you can work and collaborate both within your organization as well as externally with other people. And I specifically am a tech consultant here at Box, so I help our customers leverage our APIs, help them deploy with various integrations, as well as help them implement single sign-on.
So, Tosin, you're part of the Amherst Mafia, as well as Chris and Dwayne and Devendra, is that correct?
Yep, we born and raised there in the hoods of Western Mass. And quite the experience. Actually, it was Devendra who got me into movies and playing around with tech as well.
You too. Also have a movie podcast yourself, don't you?
That's correct. I have a movie podcast called Irresponsible Random Chatter, the IRC webcast. And we primarily specialize in movie commentary, but sometimes we do these random chatters where typically one of our members goes on a rant about how much he dislikes Reddit or other such things.
That's awesome. So we are hoping to tap into Tosin's vast mind grapes on occasion to help us out on our podcast whenever possible. So we thank you, Tosin, for helping us out tonight.
Oh, no problem. It's my pleasure.
And Dwayne should be joining us later on tonight. He's running a little late. He's trying to get home, and we'll have him as usual. So on tonight's show, we'll be talking about Microsoft launching Windows 8, Surface, and Smart Glass. Apple gets a bit of color and launches the iPad Mini, as well as a slew of other product upgrades. Should you trade up your third-generation iPad for the Lightning Pad? Stick around and find out. And Zynga uses Apple's launch to cover layoffs of over 100 employees. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And it's been a couple of weeks. We skipped last week, having a show on last week, so this is our first show back in a couple of weeks. And since then, a lot of tech has entered into my household. First of all, was the new Kindle Paperwhite, which we've discussed in headlines on a couple of different episodes, and Devendra has discussed his experience with the Kindle Paperwhite. But now I've got my own Kindle Paperwhite, and I love it. I think it's great. I noticed that there is, there was a sort of qualm about one of the complaints about the Kindle Paperwhite is the there is kind of a faint at the very bottom edge of the Paperwhite. You can see a little bit of the LED sort of shading at the bottom. It doesn't. The lighting isn't spread evenly. It's spread evenly across the whole page, but at the very bottom, you can see a little bit of the lighting highlights and shadows. And as far as I'm concerned with that complaint, I'm going to go with the Louis C.K. Opinion in that what this technology is providing us is so incredibly vast that to complain about something like that is just quibbling. So it's a minor point on what is a terrific device that offers some great usability. So it's really nice sharp edges. I love the I've never had an e reader before, so this would be my first e-reader.
Is this your first
general.
E-reader? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. My first device in general, e-reading device in general. If you're not counting the iPad, which I initially kind of bought the iPad to be an e-reader, but I like the fact that this is like an e-paper device, and that front lighting is just so nice as well that you can it's just a beautiful looking device.
Yeah, once you have your first e-reader, you realize that they are very different from tablets. Like, you do reading on a tablet and you do reading on an e-reader, but I feel like they're very, 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 very different devices. And I really can't imagine either of them really getting to the point of replacing the other in the near future. I mean, the things that make the e-reader good are the fact, almost the fact that it's a single-use device. Like, it's one of the few devices I can think of that, rather than barraging you with more stuff to do, actually helps you to focus on what you really want to do.
I
find that to be honestly its biggest feature.
Also, I was getting eye strain with using the iPad as an e-reader, and I haven't experienced that at all with the Kindle. So it's definitely it's definitely more akin to reading an actual physical paper book than the iPad. Also, another device that has entered into my life is the Epson 5010E 3D projector, and that is a replacement to – I had an Epson 8500 UB projector that broke down, and this is the replacement. That one was under warranty, so the warranty essentially paid for this replacement, which turns out to be an upgrade. The first time I've experienced 3D, a 3D Blu-ray in my house, so it's a fantastic looking a device. It's really bright, contrast is high, and you know, just watching Avatar and Prometheus in true, you know, 3D with this device is phenomenal. And so I'm looking
Did you say it was a 3D projector?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, something that projects it on the wall, but in 3D?
Yep, and it uses...
How does that even work?
It uses a shutter system, active shutter glasses. So it will project...
So it doesn't actually need any sort of...
It doesn't need a separate, two separate, like light engines. It does it with one, and it just varies the images between the two at such a rapid rate that it syncs with the active shutter lenses, so that your eyes perceive 3D.
Interesting. And how are the angles from where you've been sitting and viewing it? How does that compare to your previous projector?
You know, well, this projector overall is even brighter, and I think the color is more vibrant than the previous projector. And wherever you sit in the room, your viewing angle doesn't really affect the image at all. It's fairly consistent wherever you sit in the room. So it's really a nice experience. I think the only drawback that I might have to say about it is that the active shutter lenses do knock off quite a bit of light from the image. So the projector compensates. Whenever you've got a Blu-ray image on, the bulb goes into like high mode, and it projects a really strong image on there to try and compensate for the how much light the lens is knocked down, but it's not quite as bright as with the glasses off, watching non-3D material with the glasses off, unfortunately. So, but that is just an artifact of the technology in general, I think. And the other thing, when I first got this projector, I hooked it up to my amplifier, and I discovered, much to my dismay, that my amplifier was not capable of passing through an audio signal that had the 3D HDMI signal. So it was basically an outmoded amp. So I had to buy a new amplifier that would pass through that 3D Blu-ray signal in order to hear audio through the projector. I mean, the audio from the Blu-ray and pass that through into the projector. So I got a new amplifier as well. And this is the first time I've ever got a networked amp. So this amplifier plugs right into your network system. And the best thing about this is probably the coolest thing ever, is that you can control the amp through an iPhone or an iPad, through an app, basically. And on that app, you can control what input is going into the amp and the audio processing and basically every function that the amp has, you can control directly through an app on the iPad or the iPhone.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. So it's great, like, being in like two rooms or across the whole house and being able to crank up a song that's playing out of a song that I've got in my iPhone, channeling that through the amp wirelessly.
That's more of what I want to see, like, coming out of electronics. Like, honestly, what I'm more interested about the future of electronics is not how awesome are individual electronics coming. It's that, like, seamless being surrounded by your music and mm-hmm. sort of media experience, you know? They keep advertising it in the commercials where people walk from one room to the other and continue watching a movie. But, like, I want that to happen not just with my, you know, TV and everything, but just be able to be like, oh, I want to do a Google search. Instantly the TV's on, I'm doing a search on it, or play a song or whatever, you know? Like, that's what's really cool, that we're starting to see more of that, you know?
Yeah, it's that futuristic sort of, you know, push and pull media from various screens that you see in movies, even in like Prometheus, where they toss an image from one screen to another device. That's really where that's I think kind of the hope that I have as well, that it's like that seamless and that quick and that efficient too. Mm-hmm. It's not mm-hmm. as segregated as technology has been in the past, where, you know, if you are on an Apple device, you have to stick with Apple, with other Apple devices for them to talk together efficiently, and there's this kind of cross collaboration.
All right, let's talk about some of the headlines here before we launch into our main topic. First and foremost, it's been a while since we've heard from Kim.com, the founder of Mega Upload, since he was indicted by the U.S. government for a conspiracy and thrown into jail. But we have news that they're preparing to launch a new service called Mega, and they describe it as a unique tool that will solve the liability problems faced by cloud storage services, enhance the privacy rights of internet users, and provide themselves with a simple new business. And critics fear that Mega may simply be a revamped version of Mega Upload, cleverly designed to skirt the old business's legal issues without addressing the concerns of internet privacy. Yeah.
Hopefully, the people who like it are also believing that it'll be the same version of Mega Upload, permanently redone.
Although they're kind of positioning it as putting the keys in the hands of the end user, but it does kind of, on one hand, you know, it does look like, okay, they are just finding legal ways in which they can protect themselves.
Uh-huh.
And not necessarily dealing with the situation of, you know, content which is stored in locations that doesn't actually belong to the end user. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on the other hand, I think it's kind of that sort of out of sight, out of mind ideology that they're right. going with.
Yeah, they say that it'll be up to users and third-party app developers to control access to any given uploaded file, be it a song, movie, video game, book, or text document. And because the decryption key is not stored with Mega, the company itself would have no means to view the uploaded file on its server. So they're like, they're trying to figure out a way for them to have it both ways, for them to have this sort of storage locker that could contain any sort of legal or illegal content in it, and yet kind of wash their hands of any sort of liability, potential liability. Okay, moving on here. We're going to talk about the Apple's launch earlier this week, but during Apple's launch, Zynga laid off about 160 employees, pretty much timed right on time with Apple's launch. They're shutting down their Boston office. Their layoff is ahead of what is expected to be a weak third quarter earnings report. 5% of their company's full time workforce has been let go. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's just another notch in the ongoing downward spiral of Zynga. And it just kind of betrays the fact that I think maybe the Zynga's business model is not as robust as they had initially envisioned. I don't know, what do you guys think?
Well, I thoroughly agree. I mean, I saw the writing. I mean, I've never been a big fan of Zynga to begin with, yeah. But the writing was on the wall a few months ago. There was a report that Zynga's market valuation at that point was about $2 billion. That was their full-on market cap. And at that point, they had $1 billion in cash and $1 billion in projected revenue for the rest of the year. And when your market valuation is basically equal to the amount of cash that you have, which is what they had in this case, and there's literally no plus on top of that that means that the investors, whatever they're looking at, are extremely, extremely, you know, negative on the, you know, future growth potential of this company. And honestly, I think even still they've actually dipped below that, which means that their market valuation is even lower than what it would simply if you just simply had their cash. Which is a deeply, deeply, deeply bad sign. But in terms of their business model, I'm not sure. I mean, so what's their business model? Fundamentally, they're a game studio. They're not really anything fundamentally different than EA or Blizzard or basically any other game studio out there, with the exception that rather than putting a great deal of time and care into making high-quality games, particularly games with a long life cycle, you know, so that, you know, not every Blizzard or EA game is a hit. Well, maybe every Blizzard, but not every EA game is a hit. However, when they do make hits, they have a long life cycle. They can provide enough income for the company in order to cover all the ones that don't. And more importantly, they're also working on very established platforms that people have been demonstrating they like for 30 years now. Zynga was basically just simply trying to churn through games as fast as they possibly yeah. could, with the direct knowledge that their games weren't fun. I mean, they knew that their games weren't fun. They knew that the vast majority of their income was coming from 0.1% of their users that were, you know, obsessed with their game. Mm-hmm. And that in particular is just the most worrisome thing. When the vast majority of your income comes from, you know, a tiny percentage of your users, you know, a small improvement in these people's ability to get therapy is going to kill your business. Right. I mean, I don't know. It almost seemed almost like predatory. Like, you know, right. There were stories of people spending like $10,000-$20,000 a year on some of these Zynga games, and like, I'm not a psychologist, but it just seems like that's almost like finding people who have like a, I don't know. It just seems predatory.
Like getting kids hooked on smoking.
Particularly evil way. Yeah, exactly. It's like smoking almost.
You heard it here. Zynga is like smoking. Well, the future outlook doesn't look too bright for them. I mean, this is coming into the holiday season, where typically for, you know, more, I don't want to say normal, but standardized gaming, mm-hmm. this is the season where you make back quite a lot of money you may have lost earlier, or at least you have some growth, and it only looks like a continued downward spiral. I don't see anything. Do you guys hear or see anything that senses that they could recover from this even next year? Any new direction? Any change? Because it doesn't seem like it on my end.
Honestly, see the opposite for. So what, this year has been the year in which all the big companies flubbed mobile. Facebook and Google have, you know, seen a substantial amount of traffic lost to mobile. And, you know, Microsoft will let to see whether or not they succeed or not on it. You know, Zynga has also seen this. Zynga has almost seen the most dramatic sort of drop into mobile. I mean, they bought – they spent a ridiculous amount on that word game earlier this year that I can't even remember the name of.
Draw Something?
Draw Something, yeah. They spent $200 million on it, and yeah. I can't remember the name of it. and that was supposed to be their, like, big move into mobile. It's basically entirely, you know – I think their only really big mobile success was Words with Friends. And more importantly, they're just simply not able to monetize mobile in the same way. Or people are just getting bored of that style of game. But honestly, the fact that everyone else is struggling with mobile and Zynga – who just absolutely desperately needs to get on there more than anybody else, like, that's a bad sign.
I have to say that I still do play Draw Something on a daily basis, and if you're on Facebook and you want to play Draw Something with me, connect with me and we'll draw stuff together. all right, let's move on here. So... last week we talked about the impending launch of Microsoft Windows 8 and the Surface, and they both have launched this week officially. I have no idea. I've been trying to get some sort of like news internet reaction on what people think of Windows 8 now that it's actually in their hands. And I couldn't find anything anywhere, any sort of news about sales or anything, any sort of anecdotal review outside of official tech reviewers. I don't know. Have you guys had a chance to play around with Windows 8?
No. And honestly, that's actually a good point. I mean, we had Apple's first day sales numbers, you know, within a day or two of doing it. I haven't heard any sales numbers. I agree. The interaction I've heard has basically been, well, it hasn't been terrible. I mean, I haven't really seen that much deep-seated hatred for it, other than a few Reddit image captions, which I don't think counts. but I haven't heard anything overwhelmingly, you know, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I love Microsoft again. This, you know, reiterates everything I've loved about them. I mean, it just sort of seems like people are like, well, this is interesting. It's like everyone's sort of collectively chewing.
Right.
waiting digesting. To see what they think of the yes. new dish.
Yeah, no, that's really a sound way of putting it. Now, I know a few colleagues who picked one up, uh-huh. and from what I can see, they seem to be enjoying it. It seems to be a pretty good OS for that device. But other than that, there's just not that spark that you see with like a Apple or a Google, you know, announcement. It just seems like, you know, to a certain extent, it seems like people are more waiting to hear about Windows 8 on the PC and its failure more so than like any other device that it's launched in. And it just, I don't know, it just seems like it, you know, they've tried their best to amp it up and no one's really biting.
Yeah, I really want to. I really have been meaning to get a hold of the IT department where I used to work with Devendra and, mm-hmm. and Tosin too, actually, and just find out like what their perspectives, like, you know, quote unquote, in the trenches are. Because, I mean, thinking back on that, like, it's, you know, I'm going to leave the tablet thing open. I mean, it seems like the tablet experience on Windows 8 is at least passable, if not good. But the fact that it's also the desktop experience just kind of makes me just – I don't know. I don't even know what to make of it. It just seems like a – and since I don't know what to make of it, I can just imagine, you know, think about it. Everyone uses Windows, like right. everyone. This is the equivalent of every single car manufacturer replacing the steering wheel with a joystick or something. I mean, this is a huge change.
Yeah.
And this isn't, you know, just like, you know, a small change for a small number of users who are going to, you know, be impassioned and convince everyone else to use it. This this is a massive, massive, massive change. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to take a while to figure out what the reaction is going to be, because it is a massive change. It's also a slow ship to turn. Like, sure, people aren't just going to buy it all at once.
I have a feeling that Enterprise is going to be the last to adopt Windows 8. And that'll be like the final sort of stamp of approval if or when Enterprise does adopt Windows 8 en masse. And it could actually be a huge turning point for OS X if they decide that they I have no idea really. I mean, if it when it boils down to it, it's Enterprise is going to either have the choice of jumping on board Windows 8, staying with the previous version of Windows, going to OS X, or going to Linux.
I think if Microsoft is being smart, and I don't know yet if they are or not, what their strategy probably should be in this situation is Windows 7 has a fairly good adoption rate right now.
Uh-huh.
In enterprise, basically across the board. Vista is pretty much gone. XP, the people who are still running XP are never going to upgrade. So if they're being smart, then what they're going to do is focus this version of Windows 8, mm-hmm. on the consumer experience, the tablets, the families, that sort of user, work out the bugs and the kinks, polish up the experience for either Windows 8.5 or Windows 9 with a much more enterprise focus. I mean, a lot of enterprises are on a 4-year sort of replacement cycle anyway, so maybe they think, you know, we're never going to get enterprise to jump this big anyway, so we're just going to focus the entire thing on Windows 8 and then get the rest of the people to sort of catch up later. Now, I have no idea what their licensing deals are with enterprise, or if they're enabling, you know, Windows 7 to continue to ship. I don't know. I mean, maybe at the same time, I think they also realize, you know, with Vista that, you know, well, if you allow people to continue to install your old version of your operating system, people are just going to continue installing the old version of your operating system forever, and they're never going to upgrade. But I don't know. There is a way in which I think they could actually get through this smartly and deal with that enterprise problem. I mean, it's going to hurt for a couple years because it's really nice when enterprise loves you. And you're right, there is always the danger that Red Hat or I guess Canonical maybe, mm-hmm. or most likely OS X, you know, could take over and really, really sort of take their lunch.
And I feel like that at that point, that would be really the biggest tipping point ever for Apple. I mean, that could really change the landscape entirely from what we've experienced with enterprise over the last, you know, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, but I really think that change is coming. I think, you know, this is a huge gamble on Microsoft's part, and primarily because a lot of what I see, so especially working from Box now, a lot of what I do see is a lot of CEOs, a lot of corporations are now handing out iPads like candy because, mm-hmm. you know, what is the most powerful thing to date? A mobile worker. A worker who can access their content anywhere and be productive, you know, on a train, on a plane, you know, anywhere in the world, right? And when you make a drastic change like this on your OS, that is another kind of notch for Apple in the sense that, hey, well, you know, although you have your information here on your iPad, which you can work with, well, you know, you can also get yourself an Air, a nice light mobile device, which mm-hmm. will synchronize well with your iPad, and you can definitely see the tide turning. Now, we'll see what happens, especially since they do now have their own tablet out. You know, mm-hmm. maybe something will catch hold, but at least in the enterprise markets, you know, anytime we have high executives over, they spend most of the time, you know, working collaboratively with us just on their iPads throughout the entire session. No need to have a dedicated, you know, laptop or even a mobile desktop.
that's really fascinating, because we've talked on this show before about the death of general computing, and to consider that it's basically it's a validation of that sort of mind think that that we could all be going to portable computing, to tablet computing, even in a large scale enterprise sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this definitely sort of fits in with that transition. I mean, that maybe Microsoft realizes that and realizes that. Although I don't know, it almost looks like Microsoft is still attempting to dominate everything with everyone. You know, I mean, it's really a drastic and almost radically different strategy. Every other company that's successfully gone into mobile has done so with essentially something built from the ground up. Android, iOS, the Kindle, even Amazon's version of Android. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are all brand new operating systems no one has attempted to do yet. I guess the closest thing you can say to this is when Nokia came out with Migo, which was the right. Linux-based mobile. And I unfortunately don't know enough about that to comment on.
I don't think anybody does, really. No.
I think that had other issues going against it.
Let's talk about, since we're talking about Windows 8, let's talk about Windows Phone 8, which also launched today.
Which is apparently a different thing?
Well, you know, from what I understand, it's Windows Phone 8 is based on the NT kernel, which is the same kernel that Windows 8 uses, and several generations of Windows for the desktop that came before it used, which actually can even trace its roots back to Windows CE. So Windows Phone 8 launched this week, and I think the jury is kind of still out on that one too. But it also marks like a huge transition for the Windows Phone ecosystem in general. I took a look at a review on this on Verge.com, and some interesting points in here that I thought were kind of neat. They've got a full like wallet and NFC implementation. There's a sort of guest mode that they have for kids called Kids Corner, which is something that I think that I've been kind of wanting on iOS for a long time. Something where you can just flip a switch and then let your kid just use your phone and do whatever they want to. They've incorporated, they've changed Zune Pass to Xbox Music Pass. Like basically anything on Windows 8 that was Windows 7 that was previously named Zune, they've changed over to Xbox, like effectively completely closing out the whole Zune legacy.
Which is smart. I mean, Zune just, it's one of those brands that is more of a detriment than an asset. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing that people, I mean, I know Devendra kind of likes a Zune, but it doesn't matter the outliers. It matters. The general perception is Zune was a failure and a sort of confusing one at that. Wait, let me just get, speaking of branding, let me just get the branding straight, because to be perfectly honest, I'm actually, this isn't like more commented, this is more, so there is Windows 8, which is a NT-based version of Windows, just like Windows 7, with a different interface that is tablet-based. Then there's Windows RT, which looks pretty much the same, but only runs Metro apps, which are now called something else, which I can't remember. And then there's Windows Phone 8, which is the continuation of the Windows Phone, and that's purely Metro.
Yes, but
and
Windows
only runs Metro apps.
Right, right. But Windows Phone 8 is from the has been redone from the bottom up, as in using the Windows NT kernel, which I don't think, unless I'm mistaken about this, I don't think Windows Phone 7 was before. I think Windows Phone 7 had maybe a different kernel.
And so it can, all a Metro app should be able to run on all four devices.
Yes.
Three devices. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
It's they've made it sort of consistent across all of the platforms, being that it they all have that foundation of that Windows NT kernel.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I think that was their sort of idea in the first place, is to get some sort of consistent usability across all the platforms. Okay. Which is good, you know, I think, but it also kind of cements the idea that Metro interface, previously known as Metro interface, whatever they're calling it now, is the way they're going across the board, and that we probably won't see too much, or they're not going to be emphasizing in any case that old Windows desktop sort of interface.
Gotcha. Okay, I just want to clarify that. Honestly, I mean, this is a very, very, very difficult transition for them to pull off. I understand why they're doing that. I understand why they're, you know, looking for, you know, to sort of force people to move over to the new system, why they're, you know, having, you know, trying to unify these brands across the way. But the actual transition is tricky, especially because the Metro interface, despite being the new sort of interface that has all the coolants behind it, is clearly the future of Windows, mm-hmm. is far more restrictive than Microsoft has ever been before. I mean, it used to be that whatever you thought about, you know, Microsoft's ability to produce good or beautiful or stable or secure software, at least it was open. And, you know, for a long time, that was what I really liked about Microsoft. Like, and one of the biggest reasons why I still don't use Mac is because I hate the sort of restriction that you end up stuck with there. And it seems like Microsoft, I mean, if Microsoft pulls it off well, then they will have, you know, the sort of power and sort of market control that Apple has. If they pull it off poorly, they're just going to end up being controlling and not very good, which is not good.
Yeah. I don't think their naming nomenclature is going to help them at all with the numerous versions that they have out and numerous paths. I think that's another one of those detrimental things to their success.
Have you noticed that? I want to know how Microsoft chooses the two random letters that come after different versions of Windows. I used to think that there was like a rhyme or reason to it, but now it really seems like they just have like one of those things they do for the lottery at the end of the night. And they're just, this is going to be Windows J3.
That's a Windows game of bingo.
Like, exactly. That's really what it is. Like XP or NT or...
XP, NT, CE, yeah, RT. Right. I don't know. I mean, I was like, ARM. Like, XP I thought I could figure out as like expert or something. And NT for like network. But an ME was supposed to be Millennium Edition. But what is RT supposed to be?
That's a good question. ARM... No, I really don't know. Cuz you would think it would match with the ARM processor, ARM RT remote.
Yeah.
You know, I'll bet you if anybody would know, it would be Dwayne. I bet you he would know and he'd be able to tell us in detail. Yeah. So it's kind of been a big week for Microsoft as well. They also rolled out Xbox Smart Glass, which lets Windows 8 users and Xbox users use their tablets and PCs as second screens for the Xbox 360, controlling and interacting with the console from Windows and viewing extra information about games and other content. And this is a technology that I first previewed back in E3, and I think I spoke about it briefly.
Yeah, I remember you bringing that up.
Yeah.
Has it sort of evolved since then? I mean, presumably this is a more polished version of it. Has it sort of been any? I have not seen any reviews of that aspect of it yet.
I don't think it's evolved much since then. It was pretty much a polished version when I saw it. But what I will say is that I feel like this is really this implementation of this is something that is maybe, you know, branded to Xbox right now, but it's the kind of technology that I think like everything is shifting towards. And this is just because even predating the smart glass technology, there were second screen apps for specific Blu-ray discs from Disney and other Blu-ray publishers. And you could see that this is kind of the way that everything's going. And Xbox just decided we're not going to issue a separate app for whatever content utilizes this second screen technology. We're just going to put it all under this umbrella of smart glass, and then whatever content comes out wants to use this smart glass technology, you know, we'll just give them the SDK and let them develop whatever they want to for the smart glass technology. And I think that's really the way that things are going. I think it's a very smart move on Microsoft's part, and I think that you'll probably see I would love to see some sort of second screen standard, whether everybody adopts this smart glass technology or if they all sort of conform to one sort of second screen standard. I'd love to see this across the board on all devices, because it's an obvious thing. It's a reflection of the way that we consume content nowadays. And I think that, by nature, even without a second screen sort of technology to assist us, a lot of us nowadays watch TV or watch movies with our tablet on our lap and like look up things that are connected to the content that we're looking at.
Yeah, IMDb is open whenever I'm watching a movie. It's terrible. I can't enjoy the movie sometimes, but it's addicting to want to know who is that person and what's going on.
Or Wikipedia and Primer. I had to have that map open.
I was playing with Hulu the other day, watching Revolution on Hulu, and I noticed that Hulu has got some sort of a very similar thing built in now, where you can hover over an actor's face, and it will pause the screen and give you like a bio of that whoever actor that you're hovering over.
Oh, that is sick!
Yeah,
that is really video. Cool.
So, I mean, I think it's just it's something that is a natural extension of the way we consume content, and it's due. It's about time, and I'm glad to see that smart glass has sort of made its launch, and now it's just a matter of what content producers are going to start utilizing that technology. Go ahead, Tossin.
Out of curiosity, technology aside, how do you feel this sort of thing impacts the watching experience? Are we detracting from a film, or are we adding more to it?
I think it's really an evolution of the way, I think you have to sort of, detach yourself from, a lot of people would say that it's distracting, or that you should, if you're watching a movie, you should just sit down and watch the movie. It's not the way content is supposed to be viewed. But I think that our idea of how content is to be consumed evolves over time. And I think this is, you consume content however you want to. And if you're going to be doing this anyway, it's great to have somebody kind of facilitate that consumption of content the way that we naturally do. So I think it's fine. I don't think it's distracting at all. What do you guys think?
I don't know. Honestly, to some extent, I've noticed that it's the sort of thing that happens far more with movies that I'm bored watching than movies that I'm really into. And I mean, if it's a top-notch movie, then it's not something that's distracting me during the time. On the other hand, sometimes it's also a movie that I've seen a bunch of times and it's not, and I'm much more interested in how it fits into the actor's career or the director's career And sometimes I feel like it honestly has some place in terms of understanding the movie in its historical context, being like, goodness, did this come out before or after this major historical event that it seems to be related to? I don't know. I sort of do feel like it does really detract from the watching of the movie, and I feel bad. The better the movie is, the more that I feel bad about doing it. I don't really feel bad looking up stuff during a Jude Apatow movie or something, but if it's something fairly serious, then I feel kind of stupid, and I don't know.
Speaking of continuing to speak of Microsoft and their content, the first live-action trailer for Halo 4 was released over the last week, and it was produced by David Fincher and directed by Tim Miller. And Tim Miller was the visual effects artist who worked on the opening credits of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, if you remember those credits where everything sort of kind of had that soaked in oil look to it. So this is a trailer where basically the basic description of the trailer is that Master Chief, or a somebody like a Master Chief, is abducted as a child from their bed, and it shows how that soldier is developed into a colonial marine soldier who will go up against this whatever this new enemy is, this ancient evil. I don't know if you guys had a chance to take a look at this new trailer.
No, although I think it's pretty cool that David Fincher is the one doing it.
Yeah, the trailer definitely had that, you know, Fincher movie quality to mm-hmm. it. Although it was a little odd for me because I don't know, I've appreciated the earlier iterations of Halo, but I've never really thought of it as this kind of drama. I mean, of course, it has a wealth of a backstory, which I'm definitely not that versed in. But it was just seemed a little. It was not what I was expecting. I thought it was going to be more of a, you know, I'm Master Chief, I'm badass.
Uh-huh.
Let's go take down these aliens. And it was more of a reflection on his past and maybe a little bit more contemplative.
Okay, so we have Dwayne on the conversation with us.
Hey, guys.
How's it going, Dwayne?
It's all right. Excited to talk about Google.
Yes, now let's jump into that. So Google today announced that they're going to be releasing three more gadgets before the holidays, two tablets and a new smartphone in their Nexus line. All three will run an updated version of Android 4.2. The Nexus 4, Google's smartphone, has a 4.7-inch display and an 8-megapixel camera. It's going to cost $299 for 8 gigs of storage and $399 for 16 gigs of storage.
Wow.
Yeah. It's going to go on sale November 14th at T-Mobile. As far as the tablets go, they've revamped their Asus Nexus 7 to double the memory while keeping the same pricing structure. For $199, they'll get 16 gigs of storage for that. For $299, they'll have 32 gigs of storage. And the Nexus 10, which is a Samsung device, will have a high-definition screen with better resolution than the iPad and designed to make it easy to switch between user profiles on the same device. That'll be $399 for 16-gig version and $499 for the 32-gig version. It's the first time that Google has stepped up directly to compete with larger tablets such as the iPad or the Surface. So Google's in the game with the Nexus 10.
I mean, these are the three players, right? This is it. These are the guys who've been duking it out over what you've been using and where you've been going the web for the last last 10 years. Apple, Google, and Microsoft. Microsoft is the older, venerable champion. Apple is the guy who waited until he had, like, the mature iOS. And Google is the Google's a 10-year-old company, but compared to the other two, they're an upstart. So this direct competition with Apple, with these two devices, like better resolution than the iPad, all that other stuff, it's exciting because it's not just coming from some third-party manufacturer. It's coming from Google. It's coming from the Nexus guys, the guys who can deliver hardware and mm-hmm. software together in a package that's going to be upgradable. And Microsoft is doing the same thing, which to show that despite the fact that Microsoft has been there first and Google was there later, they're both playing Apple's game when it comes to hardware and software together.
Right.
Yeah, I dropped by Fry's today because I really wanted to see some of these new devices before, particularly more the Windows ones, but even just the Nexus 7.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I understand why Apple and Microsoft are taking the in-store experience in their own hand, because even at Fry's, which I like, you see these devices and they're all off, and it's like, well, there is a rectangular tablet thing called the Nexus 7, and I have no idea what it's like.
Yeah, you think the retailers who are suffering because of these Apple stores and Microsoft stores would take some cues and create a more curated experience, something that allows people to play with the devices that they have. I mean, I don't know how slim their margins are, so they have to, like, not be able to have real devices. There was a time when everything was just a plastic mock-up of an actual device, and I'm glad that time is over. But the non-powered, turned-off stuff, I mean, it's not something that's going to get people to continue to come to your store, even at Fry's prices, which are amazing.
All right, I think that does it for our headlines. Before we get into the main part of our show, I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week I'm going to suggest a book that I've already suggested on a previous episode, which is Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. When I first suggested that book, I just about hit the halfway point on the book, had not finished it. Now I've finished the book, and I've seen the movie that is based on that book, and I have to say that I still recommend it. It's a terrific book. It was the won the Man Booker Prize in the year that it was published, and now it's a major motion picture. I've seen the motion picture. It's extremely faithful to the book in all the ways that matters. I don't know. Have you guys, any of you guys seen the movie?
The Cloud Atlas?
Uh-huh.
I have not, although it is on my list of movies to watch. It just looks like one of those almost must-see regardless of the quality type movies. And it looks, and I've heard amazing things about the book. No?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, they have good actors. It's got a lot of production value. I feel like I'm going to need to enjoy the book, and then I'll think about seeing the film.
Well, that's definitely me.
I'm old school.
It's definitely on my list to see. It's quite the ambitious film with what it's trying to do, especially replicating a book of that magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's where the Game of Thrones thing shows up, like a series maybe a miniseries. I'm just worried about the movie.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how it does when it comes out to my neck of the woods. But it's definitely one of the films on my list of things to view.
I have to say that I was incredibly impressed with just the editing alone, the way that the editor managed to juggle between all of the six stories and keep it fresh and keep it alive and not ever boring. Was really an impressive feat, and the fact that they were still able to remain faithful to the book to an extent that I didn't miss anything that wasn't similar in the book. Anyway, that book or any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles can be yours for free by going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Plus the free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to talk about all of the wonderful things that Apple did across the board, upgrading their product line. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas, Christopher Bernor, and Tosin Anafawakin. Did I say that correctly?
Yes, very nice. Nicely done.
Tosin's our special guest who is a tech consultant with Box.com. Dwayne DeFreitas is calling us from the road, so forgive us if you hear a little road noise in the background. And Chris, you're just Chris.
I'm just Chris, just from home, doing the usual.
Doing the usual. Okay, cool. So earlier this week, Apple announced that we knew Apple was going to be announcing the iPad Mini, but they also announced basically a revamp of pretty much everything in their line, every computing device in their line, with the exception of like the Mac Pro. So we got the iPad Mini, a new iPad, 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display, new iMacs, the Mac Mini, and some other stuff. So let's go through those kind of point by point here. So the iPad Mini has a 7.9-inch screen with a 1024 by 768 resolution screen, so it's not a
Retina display.
I was a little surprised about that. Were you guys surprised about that?
Not at all. I mean, if you think about the way Apple's rolled out these devices, they hit it at they come out with the lowest possible price point they could pull off, and they also come out with reasonable specs. The iPhone came out with a normal display. The iPad came out with a normal display. All the Macs had normal displays, and the first device with the Retina display on was the cheapest one to do it on, which was the iPhone. After that, we moved to the iPad. After that, there was a big jump to the 15-inch MacBook Pro, which is the best, one of the best-selling MacBook Pros. Even so, the MacBook Air devices have had better screens than the MacBook the MacBook Air 13, for instance, had a better screen than the MacBook Pro 13 for a couple of years now. So I feel like the priority was to eventually roll this out, and I think the real thing to push it was the idea that right now they're in this transitional shift between, you know, the moving to Thunderbolt full bore, trying to support those devices, and the Lightning connector. So when we see the new iPads and the new iPods, they're all Lightning enabled.
Right.
And part of the reason I think that some of us who have iPad third generations are suffering. That's not really the iPad third generation. It's the iPad limited edition, because it was only had a limited run. That's the whole point of that. But in any event, I feel like what they did was they wanted to push this Lightning thing after the adoption of the iPhone 5 and make it so that anyone buying an iDevice in short order uses the same connectivity to make the pain of multiple devices last as short as possible.
Right.
So, like, that's a piece. And then when it comes to the Retina thing, that's a plan that's been going on for a while, and I'm excited to see what they're doing here. But it does open up the MacBook line to have multiple devices. They're now two types of devices. In terms of the 13-inch, the 15-inch, it's a little messier than it was before.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of getting confusing. I was actually surprised that there was not Retina. I mean, I feel like Apple has, between the iPhones 4S and then 5, and then the Retina iMac, it sort of seemed like that was really one of the ways that they were going to differentiate themselves. And especially after the MacBook Pro Retina, or whatever that one's called, like, they demonstrate, I mean, that's their biggest screen so far, so it seems sort of odd that, right, that the lower ones wouldn't have it, especially coming so close after the iPad 3. Wait. Yeah.
Or yeah, the new iPad. The
new iPad. Yeah, it just seems like, I don't know, I was a little bit surprised. Although, I don't know, I mean, I guess you're right, Dwayne. I think with Apple, there's sort of always this hit between hitting a price point and getting the features they want.
Price point was key here, guys. They were chasing down. This is the first time we've seen Apple. I mean, the iPod came out, and there were other MP3 players on the market, but this is the first time we've seen Apple chase a device, and they're chasing this 7-8-inch tablet market, this mid-sized tablet market, right, in a big way.
The Google Nexus with the Nexus 7.
The Nexus 7 and the Kindle Fire, yeah. Both of them. I don't think it's limited to the Nexus 7. It came out too recently for Apple to switch gears and chase it down.
Let me ask you guys, what do you think about the price point? Because this iPad mini, the 16-gig Wi-Fi version starts at $329. Do you think $329 is a little too pricey for what they've got here?
No. I think what they're doing is they still have this great device in the iPod Touch that costs $199. That's a $200 device. When you up the screen and you add some of these features, and you have an iPad device that says classes iPad, you can't just sell it for $250. You can't just sell it for, you know, you can barely sell it for $300. I think that they're trying to hit their 30% markup, which mm-hmm. they have on all their products almost, and they're trying to find a way in between the lowest level version of the iPad, the iPad 2, and the nicest iPod, which is the iPod Touch.
Right. I think
that's sort of a bottom
sense.
End of how. Sorry, what were you saying, Tony?
Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying, I mean, their iPod pricing is sort of a bottom end for them because they're certainly not going to drop that. That seems fairly established, and yet, you know, they have to make it sort of some middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I'm saying is it makes sense within their pricing perspective. So on Apple's front, it makes sense as far as where this device lies in both price and their overall structure, but then it's a, kind of a curiosity when you compare it to market. So I think a good chunk of the price is definitely, you know, the Apple brand name and Apple hoping or at least predicting that users are already impressed with their core technology, the sophistication as well as the elegance, and will fall in line with this new device. But when you start comparing it with, you know, the Nexus 7, the Kindle mm-hmm. Fire HD, as far as like a pricing point, it's really it makes you reconsider.
It's off, yeah.
Yeah.
It's ecosystem too. The people buying the iPad mini right now, I feel like they're people who had an iPad and like, I never travel with this thing, it's too big, or some other like situations. And you know, there are a lot of people who've dialed in. They've got their iOS apps. They've got their iOS configuration. They've got their iCloud set up. And for $329, you can have an iPad that should actually move around. In fact, maybe this means that your iPad is going to sit around on the couch and it's never going to leave the house anymore because you've got the tiny iPad to work with, which is noticeably bigger than your phone. So when you're in the car using it, you're having a better experience.
I have to say that having just bought a Paperwhite, Kindle Paperwhite, if I hadn't bought the Kindle Paperwhite, I might have considered the mini, but I really can't see a sort of having one of those new iPads and having a Paperwhite, I can't really see a use case for me to have this iPad mini, which is sort of, you know, in between, especially without the Retina display.
Yeah.
I do wonder how. I mean, none of us have seen one in the wild, but I do wonder what it looks like. Because remember, this device has the same display as the iPad 2 in terms of its resolution. And having had an iPad 2 and currently owning iPad 3rd generation, I mean, the difference is there in terms of resolution, but it's not a difference that changes my perspective the same way that it may others. I'm just a little less sensitive to it. So if you were to condense the iPad 2 resolution down to a smaller device, I don't think that you'd be uncomfortable. You'd think you'd look at it and be like, yucky, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, it doesn't have the Retina branding, but it's still, I just feel like it's not, it can't be that bad. It's going to look better than the iPad 2. It has to.
Okay, so we now have Dwayne out of the car and at home. You sounded great, Dwayne. So let's talk about the iPad 4th generation. So we were saying that
iPad 3S,
right? See, iPad 3S. What I don't know what they're just calling it the iPad. But do you feel sort of gypped that they've released a new iPad like 6 or 7 months after the last iPad, not a full like cycle?
It speaks to the audacity of the Apple owner. You're like, I'm buying it because on some level
it's a status thing too. That's why I'm so pissed. But I think you're also buying it. You're also pissed because you could spend $1,000 on a jacked up 64 gigabyte Wi-Fi 4G and GPS device. And they're like, oh, if you had waited just another month or two, right. Suppose you bought an iPad in September or something. You're totally jilted. You're totally getting the old tech because we've made something better. Right. But I really think all this was about the Lightning connector. And
sure.
The fact they wanted to drop a new Lightning connector. Like, what else we got? What can we make it worth it? Right. To do?
I mean, they threw a couple of other upgrades too, like the FaceTime 720p FaceTime camera. But really, what it was about, you're right, is about the Lightning connector. So,
I definitely agree. Although I was speaking to someone yesterday, actually, mm-hmm. and they had recently, within the last month, bought an iPad and were really upset about it. But it looks like what Apple is doing is they are giving them a free upgrade to the device. So
I heard
within
the
last month.
Uh-huh.
It has to be within the last month.
Yeah,
that sucks for that person who's a day out.
Yeah,
I know.
Last month thing, but I guess somebody's got to be that sucker.
Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, the catch 22 of Apple devices, I feel like, is that on the one hand, you're playing Apple roulette with every purchase. There might be a better one coming on. That being said, I mean, having observed the way that, old iPhone and old iPods and old iPhone 3GSs and even old MacBooks and stuff continue to work long, long, long after their time is over. I mean, at the same time, it's also going to last for a long time and be useful and do its job. I mean, my wife still has her literally first generation iPod Nano and still uses it because it works great. And, something else could have come off immediately afterwards and it still would have been, great, here practically 8 years later.
Yeah, but part of it is just the idea that you have to they keep on releasing things. The iPhone 5 and the iPhone 4S are the first two iPhones I've seen where there's no artificial software limit to the capability of the phone, right? It's mm-hmm. got a bigger screen. That's about the difference. Mm-hmm. The iPhone, the iPad 4th generation, iPad 3rd generation are the same way. But before that, every time there was a new device, there was some artificial limitation. So you were like, oh, man, I missed out on that. I missed out on Siri, right. Siri or I missed out on something right. else. You know what I mean? So I feel like that's where part of the fear and the annoyance comes from. More than just the sort of it's going to last for a while. Sure, it'll last forever. But, my iPhone 3GS, it doesn't have flyover or whatever. And it lacks street view because it's been upgraded to iOS 6. And who knows if it's going to get iOS 7. Probably not, right? So I think that's where the frustration comes in. It's not even about – because it's Apple, right? The hardware is just the hardware. It's not a spec game. But it's right. What software am I not going to be able to do? What capability? What fun am I not going to be able to have? What am I missing out on?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So along with the previously announced 15-inch MacBook Pro, now we have a 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display that was announced last week.
The display is the same as the $1,000 Thunderbolt display. So the pixels, the amount of pixels in the display mm-hmm. is the same as a $1,000 27-inch Thunderbolt display. So you can spend $1,000 on a Thunderbolt display and get 1,600 by 2,500 or whatever the thing is. Mm-hmm. Or you can spend $1,600 or $600 more and get a whole computer with all that real estate.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. You're plugging, just like the new MacBook Pro 15, you're plugging it into an external monitor and mm-hmm. getting less real estate.
Yeah. Interesting. But no, I think this, it's another sort of offering for the people who like to reach that particular, who have that use case that they need a MacBook Pro, which is great for video editors, photo manipulators. It's got two Thunderbolt ports. Now, 768 gigs of flash storage, 7-hour battery life, and it's available now. But you know, one of the other like sort of big news is these new iMacs. So this new like super thin IMAX, 45% thinner display. It's 5 millimeters thin at the edge, although it does bulge out sort of in the center. FaceTime HD camera, a dual microphone, stereo speakers. It's got a Fusion drive, which combines 128 gig flash storage and either 1 or 3 terabyte hard drive, however you you choose to get it. 21.5 inch iMac starts at $1,299. 27 inch iMac starts at $1,799. What do you think of these new iMacs?
I mean, I don't know. Are you guys big into the iMac as a device? I feel like for tinkerer people, it's always been the sort of not so much computer, even though it's powerful. Just, you know, if you're going to do it, you do it right and get a MacBook Pro, or you get a Mac Pro. You get a Mac Pro, or, you know, you even get a Mac Mini, because at least you can do something in that thing, you know?
Right. No, I'm actually, you know what I'm curious about this device is more, you know, in college campuses, in mm-hmm. IT departments, as far as the computers that they have out for students to use. Mm. Because that's where I've seen a lot of these, that's where I've seen a lot of Mac penetration as far as their standalone desktops. But I am kind of surprised. Well, I thought it would be nice to actually have Retina display, because once they're, you know, with their top of the line items, with especially with their larger screens, they've also been pushing Retina display.
Sure.
So I think I was a little surprised that that was lacking.
The desktops aren't there yet. I mean, the cost of glass is the problem. The cost of this high resolution glass, and mm-hmm. I kind of feel like that's what's keeping it back. So the 15 inch was a real coup, because, and I think they were able to hit that because there's no MacBook Air 15. So they were like, we're going to make it crazy thin, and we're going to give it this Retina display, and it's going to be unstoppable. Bam. But I feel like with the desktops, there are two things going for the whole lack of Retina display. One, the glass is expensive, and two, you're not as close to a desktop screen as you are to a laptop screen, which is why for the longest time, someone will tell you that a laptop screen at 18, you know, a 17-inch laptop was like having a 21-inch monitor in front of you because of the closeness you have to it. So I feel like that's kind of where they're at with that. But this device is truly fucking futuristic, pardon my French.
You know, I feel
it's
like
some Star
I feel
Trek
like
shit.
The iMac is sort of been, I don't know, almost want to say like their introductory computer. Like, it seems like anyone who's hardcore user of a Mac is mm-hmm. either having an Air or a Mac Pro or a MacBook Pro. And I feel like the iMac is still sort of for, yeah, you know, like you were saying, Dwayne, like, you know, for IT departments, for businesses. Honestly, the iMac, actually, this might be sort of part of their attempt to get into IT. I mean, I will say iMacs are gorgeous for IT. Like, compared to setting up a Dell machine or whatever, you carry it in, you pull it out, you plug in the keyboard, the computer is set up. There's none of this, mm-hmm. like, you know, crawling under the desk to get everything.
What do you do about, I guess you have to have some sort of network-based time machine situation, because you've got to have to back it up. Right? Like, there's no ghost to reset it.
Yeah, we had a solution, Amherst. I can't remember what we did for the Macs, but we had an imaging solution. I mean, the thing is with Mac is you have all the Unix utilities that are, you don't need something like Ghost. You use DD or you know, any of the myriad of tools that, you know, exist in the Unix community for copying disks. And honestly, most of those are far better than stuff like Ghost, which honestly is kind of a pain.
Actually, I feel like this is a big, you know, aside from what you were saying, Chris, about the, so I think of the, I don't know, I spend a lot of time in the computer center at Amherst, and so mm-hmm. do you and Devinger. I think, Tosin, did you ever hang out in there?
But yep.
Right, so like we're all people who spend a lot of time helping people with the computers and everything. And that room, at least, I mean, it doesn't look the same way it did when I was there, but that room was a big living room. It was a big living room with computers that people had to share. And I feel like what the iMac really does is it's a family computer. Hmm. It's a computer for, like, I have this coworker, mm-hmm. you know, he's an older guy, he's got 3 kids and a wife, and that's their computer. It's the family's computer. And when you have the children, you don't necessarily want them to have their own laptops at the ages of, like, 6 through 11. You know
sure,
what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. And I feel like that's really what the iMac does. It's simple. It's easy to use. Some kid gets a dongle or something like that, you know, like what's it called? Like a little like, you know, a fob, like a USB stick or something from a friend. You plug it in the back. They can just turn it around. They can plug it in the back. They don't have to worry about what they're going to mess up or what they're pulling out or whatever. And it's, you know, it's there. For me, my biggest problem with this new iMac is I had really hoped that they would put some of those ports on the side, because turning your computer around to get to shit is so 1999. But I get
then it would take away from that slim, you know, form factor that the that
I know. I just
five millimeters at the edge.
We use iMacs at work. There are a few iMacs at work, and the idea that these people have to they want to plug in their earphones, have to turn it around.
That's,
that's just stupid.
I think maybe they should have. What might have been smart is to put it in the base, you know, because you've got that base that swings down from the. Yeah.
Well, it's Apple, so what they should have done is sold or paired it with a pair of Bluetooth headphones or some shit like that. Mm-hmm. No, Wi-Fi Connect based headphones, like how the Apple TV is, and then you'd be like. Yeah, you just tell the computer when you want to use your headphones and boom. Or turn on your headphones and boom. It'll work. Just like how when you hit the button on the side of your trackpad, it works. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So they've also got the Mac Mini out. It's got a new 2.5 gig quad-core i7 processor, 4 gigs of RAM, dual 1 terabyte hard drive, starts at $599. This is, seems like to me like a device that I'd be more likely to buy.
This is the sexiest computer Apple makes. Hands down, the Mac Mini, absolutely. You can configure this thing almost any way you want. You can put up to 16 gigs of RAM in this thing. I have a Mac Mini. It's a 2010, so the last one with the drive in it, little aluminum thing. And, like, I use that thing for everything. It's syncing shit. It's, you know, like, it's putting music on shit. It's it's converting shit. It's just, if there's shit, it's doing it. And it's a workhorse, and it's cool, and it's quiet. It's in a cabinet. You never see it. It's attached to a television set that it never actually has to talk to because, you know, I'll just like screen share on Twitter or whatever. These are amazing devices for what you're getting, and the power consumption on these things is ridiculous.
Yep.
There is none. Yep. So
they're almost like the perfect utility computer because they're powerful enough to get, I mean, certainly they're far more expensive than something like an Arduino. On the other hand, I mean, you could do just about, they're almost like a home server.
Yeah. That's exactly how I see
exactly what it is.
Yep.
So like quite a lot of people use these to, you know, hook them onto TVs and use them as remote servers for displays. Just, I believe this is what we use in our office for some of our display TVs that are just in the hallway. They're just hooked up to Mac Minis as servers.
We have an older Mac Mini, you know, white top, old school, and that's actually used. It's connected to like a TV, and it's actually used to display our tracking at work. So like, how are the campaigns doing? It's like running all those numbers with some raw data that it has access to. So it's showing like graph, you know, visualizations of that data throughout the day. And it really is like, you know, it's a phenomenal device. And for the price, you can get a this computer for $599 with, you know, a dual core Intel Core i5 and quiet as all hell. But if you max it out, if you push it to the whole super server version for $1,000, you're getting a true server. You're getting a device that's, you know, it's sitting right up there with the MacBook Pro 13 in terms of its power. But it's only $1,000 because there's no screen attached, there's no battery in it or anything like that, and you're really able to get a lot of it. And the HDMI port that they put on that thing back in 2010 really made it the tinkerer's toy for your television set. You put that and Plex together, and you have, you know, a system that was just really phenomenal. So I don't know. I really like this computer. I have a Mac Mini, like I said. I'm looking at this and I'm like, how can I swing? How can I sell to my lady that we should get another one? It's terrible.
Yeah, no, I have to admit, this is to me something that, like, I've always wanted to get a little, you know, basically a media server like this. I have a Drobo, but that Drobo runs through another, you know, runs through my desktop Mac, which then runs through the network. So my full size Mac Pro is acting as the sort of network server for the Drobo. But I really would love to have something that's not as, you know, not as heavy duty, less intensive to hook up to that Drobo.
Get this puppy with a fucking Fusion drive and a Drobo 5. Thunderbolt, and you are fucking screaming around your connected house. You don't need a fucking rack. You don't need anything. This is like all you need. I love this machine.
I'm with you.
Optical out for your audio if you want to plug it into like a system. That's got everything you need. It's ridiculous.
So also along with all of those other updates, they updated iBooks. They made it they gave you the continuous reading option on iBooks, which I thought was a clever, sort of clever like addition. It's not
Has PDF capability. Mm-hmm. Great. Don't sell me on iBooks.
It's not a make or break for me. I mean, I'm doing good with the other Google Play and Kindle are fine. But I do like the continuous reading option.
There's one last thing about the Mac Mini. You notice this is the first one not to have a discrete video card. Last time around, you bought it and it had like, you know, Core 2 i7.
Uh-huh.
You get it. You could get a dual Core i7 Core 2 with an AMD card and or the Intel 4000 card. This time it's only Intel 4000. So they're really saying that this is a server device. It's not, you know, Intel 4000 is fine for a lot of like low level games, but you're not really going hardcore and like the traditional, you know, power user here. This is something different. This is something new.
Since we're let's shift away from Apple's announcements last week onto a couple of other Apple topics here before we sign off for the night. Now, Dwayne, you shared this link with me about iCloud. Despite the prominent addition of sharing features in iOS 6 and Mountain Lion, Apple's concept of sharing is actually a narrow one. In an increasingly interconnected era where people are spending more and more time sharing words, images, files, and more with other people amongst a very variety of devices, that's a problem. So you brought this up to me. It's basically an article highlighting sort of Apple's deficiencies with iCloud as sort of the cloud storage, their cloud storage paradigm in general.
It's cloud, which means it's connected storage. It's,
yeah.
It's through a pipe. But it's not connected in terms of people being able to collaborate and share. Right now, I can share any file with you over Google. I can share any file with you over Dropbox. I can share any file with you over a whole bunch of other things. But I can't actually share my iCloud stuff. And, I mean, part of that is because, you know, iCloud is very much attached to your Apple ID, which is a private thing. There's AirDrop if you're physically nearby. Apple likes to create these devices. Their best-selling devices are single-use devices. You can't share an iPhone, really. You can't share an iPad, really. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's part of their strategy here. But I'm not saying that this stuff isn't coming. I mean, let's face it, Apple's notorious for as much as I love their stuff. They're notorious for saying, oh, that's a reasonable feature. We'll enter that in sometime in like, you know, the next version of whatever, even though we can do it today. It's just a situation where these devices that are supposed to focus on the creative people,
mm-hmm.
With this new OS that's supposed to focus on like the creative people, doesn't allow these creative people to collaborate effectively. It's this cloistered situation in terms of what's going on with the shared stuff. Just kind of like how their computers have become. Very much taped together, you know, like they're glued together. You can't move everything. So while they're talking about working for, you know, making these devices that allow creative people to be creative, there's a certain level of creative that I think the four of us fall into, which is the tinkerer, the person who's going to look at what's going on, find a way to make something augmented, special, new, different, add to it. Hey, what do you guys think of this? Hey, what do you guys think of that? Let me try this out and try that out. Mm-hmm. You can't do that with their hardware, and you can't do that with supported by their software, their iCloud enabled software. So it's an interesting way to look at it when they're supposed to be so focused on creation and many of the sort of like base needs that we have today when it comes to creation, especially collaboration and remixing isn't available with their products.
But you're suggesting that they may change that that stance eventually.
I just don't know. It's not here now, but we have to talk about
it. So is it just something as simple as being able to share? Is it more of the Apple doesn't understand social, you know, motif we've seen?
With Ping and basically any other sort of attempt at social that they've ever had.
So fundamental to the way the web is working.
Yeah.
Sharing is so fundamental. Google has grown bigger than Microsoft in large part because, you know, what, when was the last time DaVinci opened up Microsoft Word? It's all, right? So,
yeah.
Because you can share it, because we can all be in it at the same time and do what we want to do, and it's not going to diminish our experience. It'll enhance it. But Apple is focused on these native apps, and that's fine. And they haven't allowed us to take that keynote presentation and really share it without having to think about, okay, which version is it? This is the version that I emailed to Tosin. I think he sent it to Chris. Chris made his changes. Now it's my turn, but I can't save it where I saved it before, or I have to give it another name or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not seamless for a company that's so focused on seamless. The collaboration thing, the working well with others, is something that I think Apple has consistently shown us they can't do. Whether it's whatever USB connectivity their iDevices have, or you know, the compatibility with other other types of file types or whatever, or the way their hardware is, like, you can't, like, you know, 2 years ago you were stopped being able to put a third party hard drive into your Mac because they had their own hard drive interface. Like, when they left the RISC chip and they went to Intel, they began to open up. And for a while it was kind of like, yeah, there you go. But I feel like now we might be moving back into this kind of like insular, not collaborative space that's borne out by their manufacturing and software coding practices and bleeding into the way people can use their stuff. And I think, you know, sharing is a glaring hole in it.
It's ironic to see such a deficiency in a company that is known for, like, being with basically the top technology provider in the world, especially compared to other companies like Google, where, like, Google's fundamental sort of foundation is collaborative sharing and user interaction. All right, so let's move on here to our last sort of bit of news here. This was announced today. Big changes are happening in Apple's executive roster. Apple announced that Scott Forstall, the vice president in charge of iOS, and head of retail John Browett are leaving. Meanwhile, design guru Johnny Ive, senior VP Bob Mansfield, senior VP of Internet Eddie Q, and VP of Mac software Craig Federighi, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, are all taking on more responsibilities. So, I mean, the big news is that Scott Forstall, who's been with Apple forever, is leaving. I think he's taking the hit for some of the initiatives under his control, namely Siri, which hasn't been as successful as Apple would have hoped. He was also in charge of the new Maps project, which we all know how terribly that went.
Heads are rolling over there.
I'm really surprised that people, I don't know, I guess I'm surprised that Siri is considered a failure. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just in the minority and still using it and liking it. But, you know, it seems that it has these sort of, it gets into the same thing I was talking about earlier on how, like, you know, sometimes you sort of, I don't want to say like computing that doesn't end at the end of the device type mm-hmm. experience.
I think maybe it just hasn't been nearly as robust as people had expected that it was going to be.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, I still love Siri. I use it on a day-to-day basis, especially in my iPhone 5 as far as getting me directions, scheduling tasks and reminders. So I think it's still – I think it's an amazing piece of technology. I just feel like the commercials for it made it seem a lot more versatile than it actually is. Mm-hmm. Now, they've made a lot of improvements with the latest release of iOS, but, you know, there's still a lot more that it could do. It's still – and it, granted, it is tough technology to go into. Mm-hmm. So
it's one of the few examples where Apple's technology isn't reaching – Apple's technology is behind people's imagination or intuitive nature. So normally – I mean, we saw the iMac and we're like, well, it's not really a display, but that is freaking cool. I wouldn't get one, but that is freaking cool. Look how cool it is. It's just so cool. With Siri, the potential for it to be cool is amazing. right? Like, we've all seen Star Trek The Next Generation. I mean, the only thing missing, really, is Majel Barrett's voice being... That's kind of the issue. Like, you expect to be able to say, I can't even say Siri, call Gina. Siri imports the word Siri, and it's like, I don't know. I don't understand what you mean. Siri, call Gina. And I'm like, okay, call Gina. And then it calls Gina. Like, it should understand who it is. That kind of, like, it's supposed to be this human interaction dynamo, and it's not. It's astounding. I can ask it for sports scores, and it's much more quick than if I went to the Google and started looking up Google sports scores. But it still has a deficiency in between what people expect of their verbal communication and what it's capable of, and that's where the problem sits. I think Maps also has some of the same issues. People really got Maps. They understood the mapping application. The mapping application, frankly, that Apple designed, but it had Google data. And when Apple decided to go it alone, again, with the whole, like, let's not collaborate with people, let's go it alone. When Apple went with the go it alone, the people had a diminished experience, an experience that fell short of what they know is capable on a device these days. So, I mean, those are two big issues. Like, and also think about it. When it comes to iOS, I don't know. Like, for me, I can't see a lot of new growth there. There are things they can fix, but in terms of truly innovative features, I don't see a ton of new growth. You know, like, I wish that the phone had PowerNap. Why wouldn't it? It's a flash device. You plug it in at night, it's going to do its iCloud backup. Why doesn't it just suck down all the new versions of the apps instead of me having to wait all the time and, you know, spend the 3 seconds going and say update app and having to wait 40 minutes while it updates the next 60 apps or whatever. Like, it doesn't do that. So there are things they can fix, but I'm not seeing a whole lot, whether it's Android or it's iOS. I don't see a lot of growth at this point in the evolution of the app-based smartphone cycle. I feel like that's where we're kind of at. Like, we're almost at the seventh generation of consoles, which we've been at for the last 6 or 7 years, right? Because there's not a lot there left.
One of the other things that is changing with this with these exec changes is that Johnny Ive will now be more in charge of the OS UI because that was Scott Forsall's that was his duty previously, and I think a lot of people are hanging on. Scott Forsall was championing that sort of skeuomorphic UI design that was a legacy of Steve Jobs, and I'm talking about things like in calendars, sort of that leather stitching sort of look that apps such as Calendar had, and I think people had considered that to be somewhat tacky. So
I am fully in that crowd. Like, I've always thought that Apple had really good, like, stability and really good interfaces and particularly really good devices, but I've never been thrilled with their, like, almost like kitschy devotion to skeuomorphism. I mean, they take skeuomorphism to an almost ridiculous level, to the point of, like, was there fake coffee stains, I think, on the calendar, but one of the ones, there's just something, like, just stupid. I would much rather see Johnny Ive style, you know, it's a device, it's electronic, it's an abstract device, let's treat it like such, much more like the Metro style than this sort of weird thing that they're doing, you know, with sort of trying to recreate old technology. I mean, that was appropriate maybe like 10, 15 years ago when we were all, you know, unused to, these electronic interfaces, but we're not there anymore. We know how it works. We're okay with it.
Do you guys see Johnny Ive working on both the hardware and the software is going to stretch his personal resources in terms of, like, who he is and ideas and creativity, so that we might see a slowdown in the kind of innovation we normally see in this these hardware devices? Like, I'm worried that his attention will be divided, and so it will be, you know, half to more than half worse.
I don't know. I mean, if he's a good lead designer like this, I think that he knows how to. I mean, he already has. I mean, how many different devices does Apple have going at any one time? Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't speak directly. I'm not a designer by any part of the word, but I mean, I think we're more likely to see a unified sort of design philosophy, rather than a half as good. Probably because I just don't think it's measurable in that way. Like, good designers understand how to take their designs and apply them in different places. I mean, look at people like Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, who design houses and chairs, you know, hugely different things. So I don't know. I still think it'd be a good thing.
I think we'll probably see like Johnny Ive's role being closer to what Steve Jobs was, where Johnny Ive will set forward some sort of directive. Maybe he'll initiate a design and then set a team out to apply it. And then they'll come back with different choices. And Johnny Ive will be like, yes, yes, no, yes, no. You know, work on that a little bit more.
And this is going to be a test of his skills of delegation and training.
Right.
His ability to train people to do, to come up with the types of ideas that he came up with, to work in his style. Almost like, I think of it as a fashion house. You know, like, the house Givenchy or like Yves Saint Laurent or whatever. Yves Saint Laurent wasn't designing everything,
right,
but he designed, you know, with a team in mind. And I think Johnny Ive is going to have to. I don't know. There's no real insight to seeing how he does that already, but he's going to have to do that on both sides. And I think on some level also, now that Jobs is gone, they're still trying to figure out the mix of how to run the company properly, yeah, correctly, without having any holes fall through. So there's going to be some shifts, and there's going to be some like significant promotions. And this is certainly a promotion if he's running both software design and or like, you know, UI, UX, mm-hmm, as well as hardware design. You know what I mean? Like that's part of what, you know, what happens when you are, you know, as successful as he is. He doesn't want to just do the exact same thing all the time. He's going to want to like break out, and this opportunity with Forrestal leaving is interesting. It'll be interesting to see if Forrestal just retires or if he has some new plan up his sleeve, because the guy is, regardless of skeuomorphism, Siri, yeah, or Maps, I mean, the guy took iOS from nothing to, yep, something serious. Yep.
I think it feels to me from what I've been reading that they're really trying to push him out, because I think one of the other issues is that I think that internally amongst the higher ups at Apple, they were feeling that he was starting to amass this sort of power structure of a power placement that was right along with Steve Jobs.
De facto, he was becoming a de facto leader.
Right.
The board couldn't have that.
Right. Exactly. Basically.
I mean, if he's the de facto leader, then maybe he should be the de jure leader.
Like if he's the guy that people are looking at internally, there's something to be said about that.
Yeah. Well, apparently.
Well, they really are trying to push him out. If you saw, he sold a lot of his stocks as well too, and made a lot of moves which show that he didn't feel wanted.
Well, it's funny because they actually, the other guy retired and then he came back. What was his name? He was the vice president of hardware development. You know, Johnny Ive would design and he would whatever. And he retired. He was slated to retire. And then they basically said pretty recently, no, he's sticking around. So maybe that's part of this too. Like, hey, we're going to get rid of four. Need you there so Johnny can focus on this other stuff. I don't know. Who knows?
Phil Schiller.
Phil Schiller, exactly.
Yeah, that's it. I remember it. Yeah. I don't know enough about the executive team to really say. I mean, some of this might have been prepping for a while. I think a lot of this is sort of, you know, Tim Cook's been sort of at the helm for about a year now. He sort of sees how people really, you know, work in team. And you know, he's really sort of taking it on as his company, and as he should. And, you know, that's important, you know, to have that control of the company. And especially with the iOS debacle. I mean, the iOS debacle has really sort of hurt Apple in terms of its perception. So... I think, you know, some head
level. He's on the same level as all these guys now. He's their boss. So I'm sure there's going to be a little bit of a, you know, pushback.
Yeah.
All right. Unless anybody else has any sort of last words here, let's wrap it up here. Anybody?
Oh, I know what you're playing with.
Oh, tell us, Dwayne, what are you playing with this week?
Okay. I have two things. The first is I'm going to start with the one that's less exciting to most people, and that's my new Rowenta. I don't know if you guys know what Rowenta does, what they are.
Are they a mixer or a... sounds familiar?
Rowenta, they're made in Germany.
Uh-huh.
Thermomix, the coolest mixer ever. But the Rowenta is an iron. Now, this iron isn't just any iron. It's got advanced steam.
What?
It uses a trigger on the bottom, which delivers steam through 600 holes into your clothes. So it gets the crinkles get out faster and more quickly. And for someone like me, who actually – I was raised – I mean, my mom's an immigrant.
Uh-huh.
You know, going to work. She had, like, clothes. I had to do the laundry. I would have to iron her like, shirts and things like that. And, like, yeah, God forbid I ever burn them. So if I was watching TV – if I was ironing, I got to watch TV.
Uh-huh.
Right? So I would do it all the time because I couldn't watch TV otherwise because my mom's an immigrant. And she's like, why
mom
would you
was
watch
smart.
So I have to this day, I like go stand in front of the television just ironing shit, whether it's for my girlfriend or like my shirts for work or whatever. So I got this, I've been using this crappy travel iron for years because I just didn't bring my iron from New York. And then I was like, you know what? And I got myself a Rowenta and it is amazing. So if you guys ever want to, it costs like, you know, you can find them on Amazon for like $130.
Uh-huh.
It's the only iron you'll ever buy.
That's really the bottom line. I mean, I guess it doesn't matter that it's expensive, but if it'll last you forever, you never need to replace it, and it works like a charm, then it's worth it, right?
Full lifetime warranty. My mom has one that's 20 years old. If it ever breaks, you send it back to them. They send you the new one. They don't care that you're going to get the new model because they stopped making the old model. I mean, it's the paragon of like German engineering and you know machinery. It's the quality is astounding. You know, it's complete like, you know, steel bottom. It's doing everything. It's real.
Is this the Steemium or the Pro Master?
It's the Pro Master. It's the one. Are you on Amazon.com right now?
I'm looking at the Rowenta's site.
I'm
right
on there
now.
Too. I was like, well, I've never decided I wanted a thing before, but this is the last one I'll ever need.
The MicroSteam 400 Platinum Stainless Steel one. Is that the one you're describing?
Oh no, Dwayne said 600 holes. This is clearly the wrong one.
Hold on. I'm on Amazon right now. I'm going to go to my most recent order so I can tell you which one it is. It's brilliant. It's the one that looks kind of brownish. It's 400 holes. It's not 600 holes. It's the DW9080 Steemium steam iron with 400 platinum sole. It's got a platinum sole plate.
Sure.
It uses 1800 watts, so it is a Hummer.
And that soft touch rear has got to be really.
Why does it need? What is making the whole the platinum sole plate out of do other than make it expensive?
I think it makes it so that because what happens is you don't want crushed by a completely hard surface. So it's got a little platinum on the bottom because platinum's a soft metal.
Uh-huh.
And it's not going to like rub off on your stuff. So it's got some sort of like platinum steel situation going on. But
less sticky on your clothes, I would imagine, as well.
Yeah, it doesn't stick on your clothes at all. I mean, like if you guys watch the video that Amazon provides, you understand exactly why I love this iron. So
I will definitely check it out.
Yeah, it sounds impressive.
I've never imagined that I would be discussing irons on a tech podcast, but you know what?
It's all part of
my wish list.
Yeah, it's all it's part tech. Of the whole tech, you know, wonderfulness that we all discuss. What's the other thing, Dwayne, that you've been playing with this week?
Slightly more mundane, but it's also
more mundane than an iron.
My girlfriend. Okay, so like at home, I have this. I've told you guys about my media cabinet. It's a cabinet. It holds currently it holds my Xbox, my PS3, the little control module for my 5.1 surround sound. It has a Mac Mini in it. It has an old WRT 54G, so the iPhone 3Gs can still connect to the internet. You know, it's got like, you know, the UPS and all that stuff in it. When you look at the television, it just sits on the box. You know, it sits on the cabinet. The cabinet has a little space in the front where the printer is sitting. And, you know, like that's what it is. But what happens is, you know, the Apple TV's into there, all that stuff.
Yeah.
My girlfriend has to pick up the TV remote, the Sony remote, turn it on. And she has to go to the right input. She has to go get the remote for the sound, you know, the Logitech speakers and turn that on. She's got to get the Apple TV remote and she's got to use that to navigate. So I went out and I sprung for the Logitech Harmony, you know. I picked that puppy, and it took about 15 minutes to set it up with every device I had. And I mean, it is astounding. Like,
are you talking about the new one, the Touch, the Harmony Touch?
Oh, I saw the Harmony Touch. It's very beautiful.
Uh-huh.
But I ended up getting the OnePlus because the OnePlus still has the Touch. It's not resistive. It is capacitive, sure. Although it's not multi-touch.
Uh-huh.
So it's single touch, but it's capacitive, so you don't have to worry about like it bumping into something. Yeah. It's got motion detection, so it pops on. It's got backlighting. It's got all this stuff. But what I really like was I also sprung for the IR blaster module thing. Mm-hmm. So there's this little tiny black square in my setup, and it drives all the IR reception down into the cabinet to hit the Xbox, to hit the Mac Mini, to hit the Apple TV, and all those, and hit the speakers and all that stuff. So one click gets you up and running with whatever you want to watch, and I mean, it's astounding. So I did a lot of research. I usually try to like max all my shit out just because I'm stupid that way. But in this case, I looked at, like, for instance, the Harmony 900, and I was like, it's not really for me. Right. The R thing isn't going to be an issue for me for like quite some time. And if I get the IR Blaster Kit and the Harmony 1, mm-hmm. I have a price point that I like even better, even though I'm getting more stuff. So there's that. And then there's the idea that with the Harmony 1 Touch, I couldn't get behind all the reviews I read about it. Whereas with the Harmony One Plus, I guess, the reviews were just, it sounds like, you know, several hundred reviews of just the happiest geeks you've ever seen. People who don't ever, like, they're not really geeks. They're just like AV dudes or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my girlfriend, like, also there's the charging dock, which if you ever have to charge your freaking, you know, batteries and your little charger for your remote to work, it's the most annoying thing ever. So my girlfriend, now she just, you know, turns on the TV with the remote. After pulling it out of the dock, it's fully charged. She does whatever she wants to do. She puts it back. It's a seamless experience for her, which is really what it comes down to. So that, you know, I'm a big fan of Logitech. I hadn't bought into the whole universal remote thing, but in an effort to make tech more seamless for her, I did, and it was totally worth it. It's great.
Cool. Yeah, no, I have the Logitech One, like the first version of the One, so it doesn't have the IR Blaster option. But yeah, man, I've been looking at that Harmony Touch, and it's really sexy. I'm really kind of eyeing it, but it's $250. I can't conceive paying $250 for a remote. I'll have to wait till the next Harmony comes out so I can get that one.
Interesting about it is that I think the Harmony Touch is one of the first ones where, for me, the big thing about the Harmony One Plus, the one that I got, was I needed the tactile. I'd been using an iPhone 3GS for remote control for a long time, and it was fine, but the tactile, like, you really need that tactile touch in the dark. You don't want to think about it. Get up and be able to basically type with your thumb. So that's where I got excited about this. But anyway, so that's what I'm playing with this week. It was also my birthday, which is why I have all this cool shit.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
All right, let's go around the table here, and I'm going to start with our guest, Tosin Unifowaken. Hope I said that again right.
You are on a roll.
So, Tosin, where can we find you online when you're not here helping us out on the drill down?
Well, you can find me personally on Twitter at Toast4321, but you can also find me on my movie commentary podcast, the IRC Webcast.
I'm definitely going to be checking that one out. Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on Drill Down?
Check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/Dwayne D. That's twitter.com/Dwayne D. You can also check out whatever I'm thinking at the given moment on flavors.me/Dwayne D. That's flavors.me/DWAYNED.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me always on Twitter at Chris Burnor, CHRISBURNOR. And then I've been blogging fairly regularly at chrisbruno.com. And then I help Chris McCann curate the list of Silicon Valley startup-related events and articles at startupdigest.com.
Cool. As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com or facebook.com/mrbabyman, twitter.com/mrbabyman. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network. on geeksofdoom.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the upper right-hand sidebar. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, other devices at stitcher.com, and just search for The Drill Down. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. You can always leave a comment in our show notes on geeksofdoom.com as well. If you got a viewpoint for any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. You can let The Drill Down help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@TheDrillDown.com for details. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down.